since I served a congregation full-time, and by a few, I mean more than 10, so you can see I'm a little rusty. But my day job these days is as a Bible professor, so you might want to take a deep breath because you have a Bible professor about to preach. You know, that can get a little sketchy. So this is one of my very favorite passages in the Bible, Isaiah 35. It's such a beautiful, remarkable, powerful vision. And I want to start by going through the passage, just highlighting for you a few of the details. And I know you may not have it in front of you, but that's okay. I'll call out some of these images and help us get into what they probably meant in the earliest time. So the first lines are, the desert and the dry land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. Now, one of the cool things here for a Bible professor is that we get our very typical form of Hebrew poetry here, which is called parallelism, and you have two lines that say something very similar, right, in order. Sometimes they say opposite things, but more of the time they say the same thing in different words. So when we see the desert in one line and the wilderness in the next, those are really talking about the same thing. I think for me, maybe for you too, when I hear wilderness, I think of a lush forest with undergrowth and that kind of thing. But the people who were writing this passage did not think that. When they thought wilderness, they were thinking desert. And I mean big, bad, nasty desert. So this idea of the desert, the wilderness, blooming and rejoicing, this is quite an image for the people in that time. The passage talks about specific places that we might not know of, Lebanon and Carmel and Sharon, and these are the most beautiful vacation spots of the time. This is where you would want to go. They had the perfect climate, stunning landscape, the kind of place where you would go and think, oh, this is what heaven must be like. You might think in your own mind of the place you've been that's been most beautiful where you thought, I wish I could just stay here forever. Now, there's a bunch of image in here. There are some images in here about God's vengeance. And I don't know about you, but that one was a little hard for me to read because it's a little hard for me to get into this idea of celebrating divine vengeance or retribution. But the people who were writing this were suffering terribly. They were enslaved. They had been kidnapped from their home far away, and they were in exile. And so they needed God to come to their aid in vengeance and in retribution. So it's one thing for me to kind of cringe about the idea of a vengeful God, but for a people who were suffering, enslaved, in exile, the idea of a God who would come to their aid and lead them to freedom like Moses did ages ago, that's who they needed, and that's who they called on here. There's also this reference to a highway in the passage, and of course, that highway wasn't like our highways because there's no cars. So a highway might have been a pretty identifiable, nice dirt road, maybe with some paving stones. I was looking at the tape here and thinking, a highway. And the highway is the holy way, a holy place, a sacred road. Anybody who wanted to be part of this group and observe the sacred rituals, they could be part of this community of God's followers and go on that highway where all would be whole and protected and they would follow God together. Now, just near the end of the passage, it talks about, again, in parallelism, the redeemed and the ransomed ones. Now, for us here, we're Christians. We hear those words, especially the Sunday before Easter, and we're likely to think about being redeemed and ransomed by Jesus. But of course, this is, you know, like 500 years earlier. So they're not talking about Jesus yet. These are technical economic terms in Hebrew, the redeemed ones and the ransomed ones. So in the ancient world, in Israel, but in other ancient Near Eastern cultures, there were these concepts where if you got into some kind of trouble, it might be fiduciary trouble, like you're in debt, you lost the family land because you didn't have enough money to pay the landlord anymore, or you didn't have enough money to pay for the food you needed, whatever the case may be, there's somebody whose job it is, it's their legal responsibility to come to your aid, to bail you out, to keep you off the streets, to help you. That, and if you were a woman in the ancient world, there was a man whose role it was supposed to be to come to your aid if your husband died and you didn't have any options, because a woman in this time and place was supposed to be connected with the family of her husband in order to have security. So these are technical economic terms for keeping people protected, secure financially. And then these redeemed and ransomed ones are going to go into Zion singing. Now, Zion is Jerusalem. So now, Kenny, can we look at the map? I told you this was going to be a little nerdy. I had to have a map. Yeah. So Zion equals Jerusalem. It's kind of hard to see, but on the left side, near the bottom, the left bottom, I put my red line got a little off kilter in the transfer, but that's okay. There's a red line near where it says Jerusalem. So Zion is Jerusalem, okay? And Babylon on the right side, to the east, Babylon's on the other side of that desert. You see that big desert in the middle? Syrian desert, that's the desert, that's the wilderness. So what happened in 598 and then for the next 10 years or so is the Babylonians, they were the big bad evil villains of the 6th century BCE. They came and they conquered Jerusalem and they took many of the leaders of Jerusalem off to Babylon in exile. Now, you cannot go across the desert. If you could, that would be about 500 miles and some change. You have to go up that, see where it says Fertile Crescent, the green part, that's where you can be. You can't be in the brown part or you die. You have to stay in the green part. And so that's more like 800 miles and some change. So they trucked off a bunch of these people up across the Fertile Crescent to Babylon, and they're in exile. So this is where we get some of the poetry in the Hebrew Bible that's been, and famous songs, if you like Godspell, On the Willows there, the songs about the willows and crying in Babylon. That's because they're all the way in Babylon, more than 800 miles away, far away from Zion. That word Zion, it's not just a geographical location, that's God's house. And after they first took that group of people in 598, they put kind of a puppet king on the throne. Well, he rebelled, and so then they killed him, and they burned the temple to the ground. Devastating. Devastating. So Jerusalem was destroyed. People are away in exile in Babylon. And what do they need to survive? How can they possibly survive? They don't have their priestly system. They can't do their sacrifices in the temple. So they write down their sacred stories. This is where we get scripture. They observe Sabbath, that seventh day of rest. And we get this beautiful poetry. I mean, imagine you're off in Babylon, more than 800 miles with this horrible desert in between you, and this poet writes, "The desert and the dry land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom like the crocus." There's going to be a highway through the desert, and God is coming. You might have thought when they destroyed that temple, God was dead. That would have been the mindset in the ancient Near East. If that temple got destroyed, if your people got destroyed, your God was dead. But no, they weren't going for that at all. So they get a poet who says, there's a highway through the desert, and it's blooming, and all the people will be whole. God is not lost. God is not dead. God is right there coming for you. So this was an astonishingly hopeful vision, a vision in which the people would be reunited as a community in their holy place in Zion. This vision assured them of their connection to God. Now, I was looking at some of the commentaries on this passage, and one of the things I found that is that, of course, my colleagues in biblical studies disagree with me on this some. So some of my colleagues have said, or at least one he suggests that this might not be from the time when the people were in exile in Babylon, but after, or even before they went, but they were still suffering from earlier outside threats from the Assyrians in the 8th century, and that this idea of the desert blooming was just being able to feel safe and secure in Zion with their holy temple. But in any case, I also found this great article by my friend and colleague Linda Day in an online journal called Political Theology Today from 2013. And what she highlighted, I thought was so great, was all the environmental imagery here. Did you notice that? What is the harbinger of hope? It's all creation. It's not just people singing, it's the creation singing, it's the desert singing. Everything is rejoicing. And I thought, how perfect, we're getting ready for Earth Day here. And I thought, well, I'll have to tell about Earth Day, and then there's this handy little thing in the bulletin about the People's Climate March. And if you didn't see that, then you could get the City Sentinel, and it has a whole bunch of other stuff in it about ways to observe Earth Day. I think that's something notable for us, that our ancient ancestors in faith talked about hopeful imagery of God in environmental terms. Kenny, can you flip through some of these blooming desert images? I just tried to pull a few blooming desert images. The desert doesn't usually bloom that much, but sometimes it does a little bit. The other thing that my friend Linda Day pointed out is that these redeemed and ransomed in the passage, it's not about spiritual redemption. This is about actual economic realities. So I've been trying to think about these economic realities of redemption and being redeemed. Who is economically enslaved? And what does that look like? So I've been reading this book by Trevor Noah called Born a Crime, Stories from a South African Childhood. You might know who Trevor Noah is. You could Google him later if you don't. He's pretty funny. But this is his autobiography. And so he grew up a mixed child in South Africa. That's what the crime was. Him. His parents, one was white and one was black, had him. And what they did to have him was the crime in South Africa in the 80s. Anyway, he writes this passage about Soweto, where he would go to visit his grandmother. And he wrote, "There's something magical about Soweto. Yes, it was a prison designed by our oppressors, but it also gave us a sense of self-determination and control. Soweto was ours. It had an aspirational quality that you don't find elsewhere. In America, the dream is to make it out of the ghetto. In Soweto, because there was no leaving the ghetto, the dream was to transform the ghetto. For the million people who lived in Soweto, there were no stores, no bars, no restaurants. There were no paved roads, minimal electricity, inadequate sewage. But when you put 1 million people together in one place, they find a way to make a life for themselves. A black market economy rose up with every type of business being run out of someone's house. Auto mechanics, daycare, guys selling refurbished tires. The most common were the spaza shops and the shebeens. The spaza shops were informal grocery stores. People would build a kiosk in their garage, buy wholesale bread and eggs, and then resell them piecemeal. Everyone in the township bought things in minute quantities because nobody had any money. You couldn't afford to buy a dozen eggs at a time, but you could buy 2 eggs because that's all you needed this morning. You could buy a quarter loaf of bread, a cup of sugar. The Shebeens were unlawful bars in the back of someone's house. They'd put chairs in their backyard and hang out an awning and run a speakeasy. The Shebeens were where men would go to drink after work and during prayer meetings and most any other time of day as well. People built homes the way they bought eggs, a little at a time. Every family in the township was allocated a piece of land by the government. You'd first build a shanty on your plot, a makeshift structure of plywood and corrugated iron. Over time, you'd save up money and build a brick wall, one wall. Then you'd save up and build another wall. Then, years later, a third wall and eventually a fourth. Now you had a room, one room, for everyone in your family to sleep, eat, do everything. Then you'd save up for a roof. Then windows. And then you'd plaster the thing. Then your daughter would start a family. There was nowhere for them to go, so they'd move in with you. You'd add another corrugated iron structure onto your brick room and slowly, over years, turn that into a proper room for them as well. Now your house had two rooms, then three, maybe four. Slowly, over generations, you'd keep trying to get to the point where you had a home. My grandmother lived in Orlando East. She had a two-room house, not a two-bedroom house, a two-room house. There was a bedroom, and then there was basically a living room slash kitchen slash everything else room. Some might say we lived like poor people. I prefer open plan. My mom and I would stay there during the school holidays. My aunt and cousins would be there whenever she was on the outs with her husband. We all slept on the floor in one room, my mom and me, my aunt and my cousins, my uncle and my grandmother, and my great-grandmother. The adults each had their own foam mattresses, and there was one big one that we'd roll out into the middle, and the kids slept on that. We had two shanties in the backyard that my grandmother would rent out to migrants and seasonal workers. We had a small peach tree and a tiny patch on one side of the house, and on the other side, my grandmother had a driveway. I never understood why my grandmother had a driveway. She didn't have a car. She didn't know how to drive. Yet, she had a driveway. All of our neighbors had driveways, some with fancy cast iron gates. None of them had cars either. There was no future in which most of these families would ever have cars. There was maybe one car for every 1,000 people. Yet almost everyone had a driveway. It was almost like building the driveway was a way of willing the car to happen. The story of Soweto is the story of the driveways. It's a hopeful place. It's the highway through the wilderness. Well, all this talk about deserts brought to mind for me the term food desert, which you may have heard of before. The term food desert refers to a situation in which a group of people does not live near an actual supermarket or a farmer's market, but only near gas stations, and therefore they have no access to real food, and in particular, they have no access to healthy food. According to okpolicy.org, food desert conditions can be found in 32 of Oklahoma's 77 counties. Now, this concept gets magnified when someone living hand-to-mouth cannot afford to buy real food, only the high-calorie, low-price, unhealthy food items. And here's where the work of our food pantry becomes the true work of economic redemption. That work redeems those in our community who are economically exiled to a food desert. Now, today is Palm Sunday, and so we read Isaiah 35 in the context of the Palm Sunday texts. In Jesus' time, this chapter, Isaiah 35, would have offered to Jesus and his followers hope for a future in which they would be united rather than splintered by their Roman oppressors. They were in another time of exile. In their time, they were exiled as a community by the Roman overlords who were about to destroy their temple again. Palm Sunday is a really odd day in the Christian year because it's the celebration that precedes the devastation, right? No spoiler alert needed. Everybody knows where we're going here, okay? It's going to be Good Friday, which isn't good. It's bad. And then after that, it's going to be Easter. But on Palm Sunday, we try to kind of block that off so that we can think about this parade with the palms that precedes the crucifixion, so that even as we shout Hosanna, even though we know what's coming on Good Friday, we know that we need to have, we need to find, we need to seek, we need to provide hope for ourselves as a community, hope for those who aren't in the community by inviting them into the community, hope, even though we know Good Friday is coming. Well, I love how Mary Oliver, who's one of my very favorite poets, brings her attention, like Isaiah, to a non-human part of creation. She writes a meditation on Palm Sunday called "The Poet Thinks About the Donkey." Can you pull that up? Thank you. She writes, "On the outskirts of Jerusalem, the donkey waited, not especially brave or filled with understanding. He stood and waited. Oh, how horses turned out into the meadow leap with delight, how doves released from their cages clatter away, splashed with sunlight. But the donkey, tied to a tree as usual, waited. Then he let himself be led away. Then he let the stranger mount. Never had he seen such crowds. And I wonder if he at all imagined what was to happen. Still, he was what he had always been, small, dark, obedient. I hope, finally, he felt brave. I hope, finally, he loved the man who rode so lightly upon him as he lifted one dusty hoof and stepped, as he had to, forward." I like this idea of the donkey, of accepting that the donkey was just what he was, not a horse nor a dove, but a donkey, waiting and wondering for the day that the desert blooms. And we travel as a united community along that highway through the desert, lined with blooms. I pray that maybe we can be brave, brave like the donkey, as we search for our own blooming deserts, as we feel our own looming deserts, our burdens. But those burdens just might turn out to be miraculous, as was the one the donkey carried. They weigh on us nonetheless. So may we be brave, for the desert awaits. But watch. Let's watch, because it just might bloom. We just might find the hope and courage to follow the guidance of our amazing God, who will show us a way to create community again, even through the desert, back to our most holy place. So let's watch, because perhaps the day is coming when we can see God's highway, a way to provide redemption and ransom for the economically enslaved in our society. With your help, friends, with your help, the day is coming. Amen.